welcome to the Andy Finn Show. I'm Andy Finn, the Finn Man, on WEBR Radio, and for the next hour, you're in Finland. Today is August 25th, a Monday in 2008, and on this day, in 1997, the tobacco industry gave $11 billion to the state of Florida for poisoning its people, I guess you say. And it's also the day that an American Nazi leader was assassinated by a sniper. This was 1967. George Lincoln Rockwell was assassinated. And in 78, on this day, the Shroud of Turin went on display for the first time in 45 years. Now, I assume everybody knows what the Shroud of Turin is, but it's the shroud that is reputed to have the image of Jesus Christ on it because someone wiped his face with it while he was carrying the cross. So it's Monday, August 25th, and 3 weeks of Olympic fever are over. And I don't know if you saw the final ceremonies. I didn't watch a lot of the Olympics, but I caught a lot of the highlights of the coverage afterwards. But the pictures that I saw in the paper and on TV of the finals, the closing ceremonies, were just unbelievably spectacular. What an extravaganza, just like the opening ceremonies. And they did the handoff to London for 4 years from now, and then they extinguished the Olympic flame in the bird's nest, the 91,000-seat arena in China. And just an amazing, spectacular production they put on. And people are saying, oh, this is a new standard. You know, the LA Olympics used to be the standard. How are they ever going to, anybody ever going to equal that? People need to remember something. China didn't treat this as a business proposition the way we do, or most countries in the West do when they get the Olympics. China treated this as a propaganda expense. And so they didn't worry about breaking even the way, you know, any city in America or even Europe or any place in the West that wants to get the Olympics, you have to put together a plan and figure out how you're going to break even. The city doesn't want to get stuck with a tab of $100 million or $500 million. Get this. China spent $40 billion on this Olympics. Right? They aren't worried about making a profit. The government said, this is enough of a PR coup. It's our first Olympics. We're going to do it right. So they spared no expense. And no Olympics will ever equal it in that regard because they have spent so much money putting it together. And they got what they wanted out of it, mostly. That is, they got, a legitimate member of the League of Nations, if you will, these days. Despite the repression and other things, China has arrived. This is reputed to be the century of China, and it may yet be because of the size, sheer size of their economy, to say nothing of the fact that they currently hold a lot of the IOUs for the money we're spending and charging to our children and our children's children. In terms of the medal count, China also has arrived. They had more gold medals than anyone else. That's a first for them. The U.S. usually gets the largest number of golds. And back in the Cold War, it was always us against the Soviet Union. And the Soviet Union, or Russia, has fallen to third. But the U.S. did win the total medal count. Now, I'm not a big one for counting these medals myself. I think it's a strange nationalistic thing that we do, but we did win more medals than anyone else. We had 110 medals, China had 100, and the next closest was Russia with 72, and then Britain had 47. And that's a huge bump up for Britain. The United Kingdom has not fared that well in recent Olympics, but they really acquitted themselves well, largely on the strength of their cycling team. Who'd have thunk it, eh? And the Redeem Team did its job. That is, the U.S. basketball team, which had lost the gold medal, famously. Now, if you know the history of this, you may know that the U.S. had never lost the gold medal until, I think it was 78. I mean, that doesn't make sense. That wasn't an Olympic year. It wasn't 80 because we didn't go to Russia. We boycotted the Russians in 80. They boycotted us in L.A. in 84. So it must have been, and then by 92, the Dream Team was in there. Must have been the 88 Olympics that Russia beat the U.S. on a very controversial shot. Time ran out. The refs called a do-over, and they replayed the last 3 seconds, and Russia scored a basket and beat us by 2 points or something, as I remember that game. And then, of course, we said, enough of this. We're not having college players anymore. We must win the gold. So we put the NBA players in there. And the Dream Team, the first Dream Team in 92, had Michael Jordan, Larry Bird, all the greats, and they kicked butt and won their games by a ridiculous margin. Well, then we got a little lackadaisical, and we sent over NBA stars that were used to playing one-on-one type ball, that is, just taking their shot and not worrying about team play, not worrying about defense, and we got beat. We got beat in the 2004 Olympics. We took home the bronze, and I think the 2006 World Games we lost and maybe won bronze. And so the U.S. again said, enough of this. They got Mike Krzyzewski to be the coach of Duke. He stressed team and the importance of bringing home the gold. And so we won all these games until the final game by a ridiculous margin. I think the average was like 32 points a game in the first set of games into the medal round. And then on Sunday, we had a surprisingly close game. And barely beat,
who was it we were playing? Was it Argentina?
No. Spain, I guess it was. I've already forgotten. But we played really well, and we still only won by less than 10 points. I think the game was, 111 to 101 or something, like roughly in that range, 107 to 97. I actually don't have the score in front of me, but it was the closest game, and they pushed us, and the U.S. shot really well. We shot well from three-point range. We shot 60% from the field, did good on foul shots. So they really gave us a run for our money, even though we'd been chewing up the competition. But Kobe Bryant, the new set of superstars, Kobe Bryant, Wade, Tayshaun Prince, and, of course, LeBron James, Jason Kidd, others, brought home the gold. And the Olympics are over. So enough about that. The Little League World Series is also over, and Hawaii defeated Mexico, so the U.S. won the Little World Series. You know, there have been years in the past where we aren't even in the finals of the World Series, the Little World Series. This is Little League play, and between South Korea, Japan, and Cuba, and Mexico, there, and other countries too in South America, there's some pretty good small fry baseball being played. And let's see, a couple of other things in the light news category. There's a proposal in D.C. If you live locally, you know that the school chancellor has shaken things up. The mayor hired Michelle Rhee, an Asian woman with some history in education reform, a lot of good track record in the reform of education, but she'd never led a school district in any major city, and we made her the head of the school district here. Well, Michelle Rhee came in and was somewhat controversial. Of course, she's coming into a largely African-American school district that isn't performing well, and she's shaking things up. She's fired a bunch of principals, and she's pumping new blood into the education system. It remains to be seen, ultimately, if she'll be successful. It's very hard to turn around any kind of bureaucracy, whether it's a losing sports franchise or a poor school system. But she has a chance to do it, I think. In any case, the controversy is she's proposing cash incentives for students. They've got a fund, and in one or two particular schools, they're offering to pay students for good grades. Now, this is controversial for a couple of reasons. There's a whole field within psychology known as intrinsic motivation, or there's a theory of intrinsic motivation. It started back with a guy named Ed Deasy, a professor at the University of Rochester, that's New York. And Ed Deasy is a social psychologist, which is my original field. And Ed Deasy wrote a book in about 1968, I think it was, called Intrinsic Motivation. And basically the theory and what his data was showing was that people are largely motivated internally to do things. And if you're motivated internally, then you're not worried about extrinsic motivation. So if you enjoy playing on a Game Boy, if a kid enjoys playing on a Game Boy, you don't have to reward the kid to play a video game. He likes playing video games, so he does it just for the intrinsic motivation he gets, just the intrinsic reward he gets of getting to the next level or whatever. The same can be true of even math problems. I remember how I was in the second grade. I would tackle my math homework, and I saw it as a challenge, and I saw it as fun. And I would work the problems and do them as fast as I could and get the right answers, and I was intrinsically motivated. Well, what Deasy's research showed was that if you take two groups of students and you pay one of them to do problems, whether it's math or some other kind of problem, and you don't pay the other, and then you ask them how the experience was, if you're being paid, you come to attribute the reason you did it was because I was being paid. But if you aren't being paid, you say, well, it was, I enjoyed it, okay, so I must be intrinsically motivated, so it was fun. So, yes, I enjoy doing problems. And given a chance to do more, you'll do more. The other group that got paid, if you say, now I want you, here's some other problems, some math problems or other kinds of tasks, and I want to know if you want to do them, but I'm not going to pay you for these, the people that were paid originally say no. So the logic is that intrinsic motivation is killed off by extrinsic motivations. So paying someone to do something lessens their intrinsic motivation, whereas if you don't pay them, if it's something that they find enjoyable, they'll do it. Now, the rub here is, Michelle Wee is a 18-year-old golf phenom. I'm talking about Michelle Rhee, the chancellor of the D.C. school district. What she and her supporters might argue is that all that's fine about intrinsic motivation research, but these kids don't want to study, they don't want to do their homework. So by giving them cash rewards, we're getting them to do something they wouldn't otherwise do. We're basically saying that going to school is a job and we'll pay you to go to school and improve yourself. Now, people should be intrinsically motivated. If you want to get ahead in the world, that's what it takes, is to do the work, and it should be its own reward. But they say, realistically, that isn't going to happen with a lot of at-risk kids. So I'm torn about this. I'm of two minds about it. And I just wanted to give you something to think about tonight. Let's see. Oh, there was a piece in the Washington Post yesterday, Sunday, August 24th, about how post 9/11, the U.S. and its allies have worked with Western banks and some non-Western banks to limit the financing of terrorist organizations. And it talks about how much it costs terrorist organizations, particularly Al-Qaeda, to mount certain operations. For example, Al-Qaeda devoted almost $500,000, $500,000 to the September 11th attacks. Right? They spent a lot of money getting those attackers, there were 19 of them after all, into the U.S., setting them up in apartments. Some of them had jobs, some of them just spent money, some of them had to get flying lessons. They gave them cash to do all these things. They spent $500 million, roughly, on the 9/11 attacks. On the other hand, although they weren't anywhere near as devastating, they only spent $15,000 on the London train bombings. Actually, there were train and bus bombings. This was in July of 2005. And they spent about $80,000 on the Madrid train bombings. That happened in March of 2004. So the bottom line is, the article basically talks about how Al-Qaeda has to get creative about financing because they can no longer move money freely from bank to bank in accounts that are known to be run by people with terrorist links. But
the dilemma here, or the problem, is that if it only costs $15,000 or to $80,000 to stage some of these, it's hard to shut off all the money. So they're going after drug money, and they're getting money from different forms of, I'll call it, organized crime, or donations from rich people who sympathize with them. But this, I guess what I want to say about this is, my own analysis is that it's impossible to completely shut down the funding. I think we should be doing what we're doing and trying to cut off the free flow of money to and from terrorist groups. But that's not a way to stifle terrorism completely. They're always going to find the money they need for certain operations. There's just too much money in the world and too many ways to get it, both legally and illegally, and too many ways to transfer it around. So we should do what we can to stop it, and we shouldn't assume that that is going to stop terrorists. In fact, rather than stop the money, I think we probably should be trying to follow the money trail. And my guess is we are. You know, during Watergate, people said to reporters, follow the money. The leakers did. Deep Throat said that. And that's what we should be doing here, is maybe letting some of it go through, but then following it and seeing where it goes and who picks it up and who uses it, who makes withdrawals. And in the words of that great lawman, Barney Fife, we got to nip it in the bud. So find out where these terrorist cells are through, dare I say, law enforcement. My gosh, I sound so democratic and so non-Republican when I say that. But in fact, long term, we are not going to beat terrorism through military operations. Military operations work in Iraq now that we're in Iraq. They work in Afghanistan out in the middle of nowhere. They may work in the mountains of Pakistan when we finally get around to getting bin Laden. But in general, if there's terrorist cells being set up infiltrating Western countries, whether it's Germany, someplace else in Europe, or the United States, we have got to use law enforcement techniques and work together with our allies to identify these cells, monitor them, track them, and then arrest them and put them away. So anyway, that's it on the financing of terrorist organizations. There was another article last week in the Washington Post about the Peace Corps and how the numbers of in the Peace Corps are actually going to start going down because of not so much budget cuts, but the fact that the dollar is not worth as much overseas. Right, a drop of 20-30% in the dollar means that the Peace Corps has 20-30% less to work with. And so it shows the budget and the number of volunteers that we have. And from 2001 through what's proposed for 2009, what we're spending is roughly a third of a billion dollars. In 2001, we were spending $267 million. That's, you know, about a little more than a quarter of a billion on the Peace Corps. And it's scheduled to rise this year. It's $331 million. So roughly a third of a billion. But, you know, that's still not a lot of money if you think about it. We spend $2 billion a day. Well, that may be a little high. We're certainly spending it's $2 billion a week. We're spending about $10 billion a month in Iraq currently. Okay? So if we're spending $2 billion a week, we're spending almost the entire Peace Corps budget every day just in Iraq. Right? That's where our priorities are. Do you have any idea how much more impact we would have had in the world if we'd answered 9/11 by increasing the size of the Peace Corps tenfold and saying, we are going to get out in the world and take action instead of going into Iraq? We had 6,600 people in the Peace Corps in 2001, and that will rise to 8,000 by this year. Now, when George Bush came into office, he said he wanted to double the size of the Peace Corps, right? Well, he's increased it 1,400 people in 8 years. 1,400 out of 6,000, that's about a 25% increase. So he said he was going to increase it 100%, and he's increased it 25%. You know, I don't think his heart's really in these kinds of initiatives. But think about this. you know, you use the resources that you develop. So one of the problems that I think Democrats and liberals have with our military is not that we loathe the military or that we think that the military budget should always be cut or that we shouldn't keep big weapons around or whatever. What it comes down to is that you use the resources you have in place. Right? So if we had 100,000 teachers trained, but we had them sitting around with no jobs, but we got them trained and we said, okay, we're going to train 100,000 math, science, English, other language teachers. We're going to train geography teachers. We're going to train people who can teach both high school and college. And if we did that, we'd have 100,000 teachers itching to get to work. Right? We'd find a place to use them. Instead, what we do is we keep a large military around. Well, then the temptation is to use it. Right? I'm not saying we shouldn't have a large military. I'm saying we need more controls on when it gets used because the temptation is just to use it. You know, since Ronald Reagan, we've had a little habit that every new president is tested either by our enemies or our adversaries or whatever people perceive. And the dilemma there is that they come into office, and if people think you're weak, one way to prove you're not weak is to attack. And so Ronald Reagan went ahead and spanked Grenada, and that showed people he was tough. And George W. Bush was called a wimp when he was running for office. And so he got in, and he went into Panama and captured Noriega. If you've got the military, you use it. And if you've got double the number of Peace Corps volunteers, you'll use them. And if we had 100,000 teachers trained, we'd use them too. So just a thought about the nature of military power. In any case, we're going to take a break, and we'll be right back after this.